to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. There are two components to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. There is the 95% that is dedicated by constitutional formula, and another 5% that's called the 5% set-aside that is allocated according to a formula that the legislature writes. But the largest share, the 95% of the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and that is, remember, the fund where those...
Mr. Williams, I think we have Representative Sanderson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sir, could you when the motor vehicle sales tax was initially incepted, could you draw a difference between what the initial income per annum was as to what it was in 2004? Do you have those numbers by chance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanderson, do you want me to go back to the beginning of the motor vehicle sales tax?
When it was initially, yeah. Mr. Chair, just when it was initially incepted, the number that we were making in revenues then, as opposed to what the revenues were received last year, the motor vehicle sales tax, do you have those
numbers? Mr. Chairman, the motor vehicle sales tax, I think, brought in approximately $630 million last year. I don't have the immediately available the revenue figures going back to the inception of the tax, which was in 1967, but I could try to gather those figures if you'd like to see them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's fine.
Mr. Chairman, as I was saying, the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund is really divided into two portions. There is a 95%, which is distributed according to a constitutional formula, and another 5% that is distributed according to a formula that the legislature writes. This 95% is distributed according to this formula, and this formula is written into the Constitution. It was adopted by a vote of the people in 1956, and it has not been changed since then. 62% of that Highway User Tax Distribution Fund goes to the Trunk Highway Fund. Another 29% goes to what's called the County State Aid Highway Fund, and 9% goes to the Municipal State Aid Street Fund. The largest share goes to the Trunk Highway Fund, and the Highway User Fund is the largest single source of revenue to the Trunk Highway Fund. The Trunk Highway Fund is the fund that basically finances the state trunk highway system, which is approximately 12,000 miles. It is owned and administered by the Department of Transportation, and it carries roughly 60% of all of the vehicle miles traveled in the state. The Trunk Highway Fund supports highway improvements to the Trunk Highway Fund. It supports the maintenance of the Trunk Highway Fund. It supports administration, the operation of MnDOT, insofar as it affects highways. The Trunk Highway Fund supports the state patrol. It supports the driver licensing program. It is a source of funding for a number of different activities in state government. The Highway User Fund is the biggest single source, but it's not the only source of money to the Trunk Highway Fund. Driver license fees go into the Trunk Highway Fund, and in turn, the driver licensing program is funded with an appropriation out of the Trunk Highway Fund, and the program is roughly self-financing. A portion of state patrol fines from the fines for tickets that have been written by the state patrol go back to the state and go into the Trunk Highway Fund. Federal aid that can be used for state trunk highway projects goes into the Trunk Highway Fund. The revenue from the sale of trunk highway bonds goes in, that is, bonds that are backed by the Trunk Highway Fund, go into the Trunk Highway Fund. And there are various other lesser sources of income, such as investment income. This indicates the sources of revenue to the Trunk Highway Fund and shows this is for the for fiscal 04. It shows that the Highway User Fund is by far the largest source of revenue to the Trunk Highway Fund. That's the dedicated 62% of 95% of the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Federal aid accounted for another roughly $350 million. Bond sales accounted for about $140 million. That number has gone up considerably in recent years. The legislature authorized $100 million in trunk highway bonding in 2000 and another $110 million in 2004. Prior to that, the last trunk highway bond issue had been 1983. So the legislature went a fairly long time without authorizing trunk highway bond sales, but then has authorized them twice within the past 5 years. The second major recipient of revenue from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund is the County State Aid Highway Fund. This is a fund that is distributed to all counties. Every county participates. It supports a county state aid highway system of roughly 30,000 miles, and that represents approximately two-thirds of the total county highway mileage in the state. The money is distributed to the counties according to a formula that's in statute. This is not in the Constitution. This formula is in statute. It can be amended at any time by the legislature, but in fact, it's had a major change only once since it was written by the legislature in 1957, and that was to change the this 30% factor from total miles to lane miles. The distribution formula provides that 10% of the money in the county state aid fund gets distributed equally among all counties, so that each county gets exactly 1/87th of that 10%. Another 10% is distributed according to each county's registered motor vehicle population. 30% is distributed according to each county's share of total county state aid lane miles. That is, a lane mile is not a total mile of highway, it's a single lane of highway. So a mile of four lane highways has four lane miles. And the largest item in the distribution formula is what are called, that is, it accounts for 50% of the formula, that's what is called money needs. And money needs are defined as the amount that a county needs over a 25-year period to bring all of its county state aid highways up to MnDOT's state aid standards. Each county prepares its own money needs estimate every year. It submits that estimate to the County State Aid Screening Committee, which is a committee made up of county engineers. County engineers make their recommendation to the Commissioner of Transportation, and then the Commissioner makes the final determination on money needs. So you can see that obviously money needs are to a significant extent, driven by mileage. Money needs are a factor of how many miles of county state aid a county has, what its projected traffic volumes are going to be over a 25-year period, and the existing condition of the roadway. Those three factors go into making us are the main factors that go into making up money needs. So you can see the total mileage is a major factor in the distribution of county state aid highway funds.
Mr. Williams, Representative Anderson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Williams, from what fund do the state or county or township take money to build new facilities for transportation needs?
Mr. Chairman, the main sources of revenue to counties for the improvement of county highways are county state aid revenues and property taxes. That is the revenue that each county receives from its dedicated road and bridge levy. The percentage is going to vary from county to county, but generally speaking, The last breakdown I saw indicated that about half of county expenditures for highways came from state aids, and roughly half came from property taxes. That's not going to be the same from county to county, but that's a very broad average.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Williams, the facilities such as putting up new buildings to like a county maintenance facility or things like that, is that something that's part of in the formula, or is that something outside of it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, that would not be included. That would not be a factor in the formula because it does not go into the money needs calculation. Those are tied directly to county state aid highway mileage and not support buildings that a county may have.
Okay. Thank you.
The final factor is the Municipal State Aid Street Fund. That is 9% of the total highway of 95% of the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Unlike the County State Aid Fund, the Municipal State Aid Fund does not go to every city. It goes to cities of 5,000 population or more. And that limitation is written into the Constitution. So the legislature cannot expand eligibility for the Municipal State Aid Street Fund. There are, after the last census, I think that there are probably roughly 130 cities in Minnesota that now participate in the county state aid system. This is a system of approximately 2,800 miles of municipal state aid streets. Each city is allowed to put up to 20% of its total city street mileage on its municipal state aid street system. The distribution formula for the municipal state aid street fund is also statutory. It's not written into the Constitution. Like the county distribution formula, it is written by the legislature, and the legislature can change it at any time. But it's a much simpler formula than the one for the county state aid highway fund. It has only two factors, 50% population and 50% money needs on each city's municipal state aid street system. That was the distribution of 95% of the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. The other 5% is sometimes called the 5% set-aside. That is a piece of the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund that the legislature can reapportion according to a formula other than the 62-29-9 formula, but it cannot do it more often than once every 6 years. And that restriction is also written into the Constitution. It doesn't say that the legislature has to apportion it every 6 years. It says that the legislature cannot do it more often than once every 6 years. The last reapportionment was enacted by the legislature in 1997 and took effect in 1998. So the 6 years have elapsed, so the legislature could change that apportionment at any time. When the legislature made the most recent apportionment of that 5%, it decided that nearly half of that money would go to towns for town roads and town bridges. Town roads get about 30% of that 5%. Town bridges get about 16%. Those were not new accounts. Those accounts actually go back to about 1983, but they were preserved when the legislature made its most recent reapportionment. The town road account is money that is distributed to the counties on the basis of their town road mileage, and then each county writes its own distribution formula for the towns in the county. So every town is eligible. The money may be used for construction or for gravel maintenance of town roads. And that's, as I said, that is on a formula basis. 16% of that 5% goes into the town bridge account. And that is not on a formula. Towns submit applications to MnDOT for distribution of money from that town bridge account. There is no automatic distribution to each town. The largest share of that 5% goes into what's called the flexible account. And you may remember that in the earlier meeting today, Mr. McFarland pointed out that the flexible account would receive a percentage of the new revenues that were being discussed from the governor's proposed dedication of 100% of the motor vehicle sales tax revenue. That flexible account was created in 1997 primarily to deal with a backlog in what are called turnbacks. That is, trunk highways that are being or will be or have been turned back to local jurisdiction. That is, removed from the trunk highway system and given to counties or cities because they more appropriately belong on those local systems. Generally, a road will have to be brought up to at least state aid standards before a city or county will accept it as a turnback. And because there, in the past there had not been enough money to do all the improvements, there had developed a significant backlog of turnbacks. Roads that were ready to be turned back and would could appropriately turn back and in fact belonged on a local system rather than the trunk highway system, but were not being turned back because there wasn't enough money to bring them up to standards. And so the ever since the flexible account was established, it has mostly been used to clean up that backlog of turnbacks. It is expected that that backlog will be pretty much cleaned up, as I understand it, within the next 2 or 3 years. And when that money in the flexible account that is not needed for turnbacks can be used for regular trunk highway improvement projects.
Mr. Williams, is there some set of standards that the road has to be brought through before the turnback takes place?
Mr. Chairman, I think that it would usually have to be brought back at least to state aid standards, because under the general practice is that those roads go on to the state aid system once they have been turned back to local jurisdiction. And counties do not want to accept those roads if they are in substandard condition. I'll move on to transit financing here. And there are two major sources of transit financing. There is operating assistance that comes from biennial appropriations from the general fund. And those appropriations go to the Metropolitan Council for transit in the seven-county metropolitan area, or to the Department of Transportation for transit in Greater Minnesota. That is administered through MnDOT's Office of Transit. There is a second source of revenue for transit, and that is a dedicated percentage of the motor vehicle sales tax. These two sources are fundamentally different in that that top source, operating assistance for transit, is a biennial appropriation that the legislature has to enact every 2 years. The second source is money from the motor vehicle sales tax that goes to a metropolitan account and a Greater Minnesota account, and that money was intended to replace property taxes as a source of transit financing. That comes from a standing appropriation that is in statute. That is, the legislature does not renew that every 2 years. It goes ahead automatically unless the legislature chooses to change it. The current allocation of motor vehicle sales tax revenue is that the metropolitan area's dedicated account gets 21% and Greater Minnesota's dedicated account gets 43%. You can see that about 80% of the operating assistance overall goes to the metropolitan area. And about roughly 20% to Greater Minnesota. The ridership, there's a greater percentage of ridership in the metropolitan area, about 90%. So there is a little. The money received by Greater Minnesota is slightly out of proportion to its ridership. The reason for that is that transit in Greater Minnesota is inherently more expensive to provide. It is often countywide, spread much more thinly, using smaller vehicles, a smaller customer base. The service in Greater Minnesota is there are certain economies of scale that simply cannot be achieved in most of these systems. The Metropolitan Council receives the appropriation for Metropolitan Transit, and in recent years the legislature has appropriated a single amount to the Metropolitan Council for transit, and has left it up to the council to allocate it among the various types of transit that the council either provides or financially assists. The largest recipient is Metro Transit, which is the regular out bus system in the metropolitan area. Then there is Metro Mobility, which is the paratransit or door-to-door transportation service that is offered to disabled persons. That is funded by a combination of state assistance and fares. There is also the so-called opt-out systems, more technically replacement systems, such as Plymouth Metrolink, Minnesota Valley Transit. These were systems that were established about roughly 20 or so years ago by communities that wanted to operate their either individually or banding together to operate their own transit systems because they believed that they could provide either more effective or more efficient transit than was being provided by what was then the Metropolitan Transit Commission, the regular out bus system. What happened then was that the replacement systems retained most of the transit property taxes being collected in their city instead of those going to the main regular route system. The opt-out communities retained that property tax revenue and used it to operate their own system. Now that there is no longer a property tax levy for operating assistance, these systems receive a share of the motor vehicle sales tax revenue that is allocated to the metropolitan account. There are some smaller systems within the metropolitan area that are assisted by the Met Council, rural and small urban systems such as the Anoka County system, Hopkins Hopperide, the Hastings systems, Dakota Area Rapid Transit, smaller systems, much smaller than Metro Transit, but which have a presence in their community and receive operating assistance from the Metropolitan Council. Finally, there are a couple of private operators in the metropolitan area that receive operating assistance. Greater Minnesota has a much broader array of recipients over a much wider area. The Greater Minnesota Transit Assistance Program includes systems as disparate as the regular route system in Duluth and small systems that basically provide a circulator service in rural areas and counties. There are four basic categories, funding categories, for Greater Minnesota transit systems. There's the urbanized systems, such as the regular route systems in Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud, and other cities. There are the small urban systems, such as the systems in Brainerd, Mankato, and Winona. There are rural systems, which are in some cases countywide, in some cases serve small towns and the areas surrounding smaller towns. A couple of systems are operated by Indian tribes, and there are a couple of systems operated by social service agencies that provide transportation as an adjunct to other social services that they provide. And there are also a few systems that are specifically for elderly and disabled passengers, comparable to Metro Mobility in the metropolitan area. These are systems in such as the Stride system in Duluth. There are systems in Moorhead and Rochester that are that are intended specifically to provide door-to-door transportation for elderly and disabled persons. The way that the operating assistance is distributed by MnDOT's Office of Transit using appropriations from the legislature is that each system is put into one of those four funding categories, and then each system is responsible for a fixed local share of total operating costs. And it is up to each individual system to decide how that local share is going to be raised. It can be raised by a combination of fare revenue, of tax revenue. In some cases, there are contributions that support these systems. All of those sources are lumped together and are called local share. Once a local community or a local transit system has met its fixed local share, which is either 35 or 40% of total operating costs, depending on the type of system, then of the remainder, whatever is not covered by federal aid, and there are federal programs that provide operating assistance to rural and smaller town transit systems, whatever is not paid by federal money is paid by the state. We'll turn now to aeronautics, and this is about a $20 million a year function that also has its own dedicated fund. That's called the State Airports Fund. This, incidentally, is not in the Constitution. And this is the biggest difference between aeronautics funding and highway funding, apart from the total number of dollars involved. The airports fund is entirely statutory, whereas highway funding is governed by a number of restrictions imposed by the Constitution. Sources of revenue for aeronautics include the aviation fuel tax, which ranges from 5 cents down to a half a cent per gallon, depending on use. That is, the more you use it, it's a sliding downward scale. The more a taxpayer uses, the less the tax rate is. There is also an aircraft registration tax. That is 1% of the base value of the aircraft. And the base value is depreciated every year according to a depreciation schedule in law. And finally, there is what's called the air flight property tax, which is a property tax on commercial airlines. It is assessed on their their air flight property, and the assessment is made each year based on how much money will be needed by the State Airports Fund to meet the appropriation of the legislature after revenue from the registration tax and the aviation fuel tax is taken into consideration. State spending on aeronautics from the State Airports Fund works out about 70% to airport assistance, and that is grants to local airports, mostly but not entirely in greater Minnesota, for capital improvements and also for airport maintenance. About 30% of the revenue goes for what are called aviation support and services. That's the operation of MnDOT's Office of Aeronautics for pilot information, for safety equipment, for the aircraft registration system, for the pilot licensing program, for public education on aeronautics, and also flight services that the office provides to other state agencies and for which the office is reimbursed by those other state agencies. Finally, the fourth major component of transportation funding is transportation carriers. The largest of these programs is motor carriers. MnDOT's Office of Motor Carrier Services registers operating authority of motor carriers. It does safety inspections and audits of motor carriers. It enforces insurance requirements on motor carriers, and it does hazardous materials regulation. This activity is funded out of the Trunk Highway Fund, and the fees that motor carriers pay for the registration of their operating authority goes into the Trunk Highway Fund. So this is another program that goes through the Trunk Highway Fund, but it's intended to be self-supporting. The other carrier programs in which the state is involved With respect to railroads, the state has what's called the Rail Service Improvement Program, which is a revolving loan program which makes grants where the state is involved in a usually a three-way relationship between a railroad, often a regional railroad, and shippers and the state, where a portion of the cost of rail improvement to either make major improvements on the level of service of a railroad or to keep a railroad operating and keep it out of abandonment. This money comes from the Rail Service Improvement Program. The state has sold bonds in the past to provide seed money for this program, and it's a revolving program so that as loans are paid off, new loans can be made for rail service improvements. The state is also involved in a grade crossing safety program. The funding sources are, as I said, the Rail Service Revolving Fund and bond proceeds. The state is involved also in a port development assistance program. This program was originally created in the early 90s, but it did not receive any funding for about 10 years after that, and the legislature has funded it occasionally but not regularly, and when it is done so through general obligation bonding. The Port Development Assistance Program is for the development of commercial navigation facilities on the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers and on Lake Superior. And it is because it is a bonding program, it is limited to publicly owned commercial navigation facilities on those navigable waterways. Finally, the state has a pipeline safety office, which is mostly involved in pipeline inspection. This is what is called a fee-funded program. There is a dedicated pipeline safety account in the Special Revenue Fund where the state assesses pipeline operators to provide the money that the legislature then appropriates out of this dedicated account to the Office of Pipeline Safety, which is located in the Department of Public Safety rather than the Department of Transportation. So, Mr. Chairman, this completes a brief overview of some of the backdrop against which budget and policy decisions will be made this session with regard to transportation financing. I'll try to answer any further questions that you might have.
Any other questions for Mr. Williams? Well, thank you very much. Everybody has got all those formulas memorized now, so we're all set. Thank you. The next, we have a couple of people that have come in. Representative Reeder, who just moving his chair around over there, is a longtime member of the Transformation Committees. And, Representative Rowley from where? North St. Paul, right. He's came in, and we have Representative Olson, Mark Olson. Representative Olson just came in a good time ago, and who else?
Hornstein.
Oh, Representative Hornstein. He's been active in transportation issues with the Metropolitan Council prior to coming to the legislature. Anybody else? All right, we're off and running on the next presentation, which is the Metropolitan Council, and you want to introduce yourselves as you go there?
Well, we're just trying to get the PowerPoint turned up, Mr. Chair. I'll start here real quick. My name is Judd Shetton, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council, and we're here today to present the Council's transportation functions to both of your committees, and we want to thank both you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Chair, for giving us the opportunity. The Met Council Chairman, Peter Bell, couldn't be here this afternoon, neither could our Regional Administrator, Tom Weaver, but I have Mr. Nacho Diaz and Mr. Brian Lamb, who Nacho is our transportation planning or services director, and Mr. Lamb is the general manager of Metro Transit. We'll be able to provide more detail into the presentation that Mr. Williams just did regarding the council's functions, and if I can just figure out how to get this up on the screen, we'll get started here, I think.
We have to...
All right,
okay.
Just a second.
Thank you for coming
to
us.
Here we go. Hey. All right, Nacho, we're going to have to see it right here. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Nacho Diaz. I'm the director of Metropolitan Transportation Services. For the Metropolitan Council, I apologize for my voice. I've been carrying a cold bronchitis for the last 2 weeks, and I'm not sure that I've been able to find out how to get rid of it. So my apologies for that. What we'd like to do today, and we appreciate the opportunity, is to give you a very brief overview of what the Metropolitan Council does with respect to transportation. And the first slide that you have on the screen right now gives you a sense of what are the two key functions that we play. One function is to be the planners for the region, if you will, and the second function is to coordinate and deliver transit services. With respect to the planning functions that we have, I think it would be important to understand two very important issues. One is that all the planning functions that we perform have been mandated to us either by the federal or the state government. We are what is called the Metropolitan Planning Organization. And the Metropolitan Planning Organization is a group that is supposed to perform federally mandated activities for planning for transportation. And this has been mandated for over 40 years in the country for communities of over 200,000 people. And the Metropolitan Council performed that function. In addition to that, we have a lot of other functions that have been mandated by the legislature since the creation of the Metropolitan Council in 1967. And these things have evolved over time because of changes in the way in which we perform those functions, particularly with the merger in 1994 of the Metropolitan Transit Commission and the Regional Transit Board into the Metropolitan Council. The other thing which I think is very important is to emphasize that the planning functions that we perform, we don't do that in isolation. We don't do that by ourselves. We do that in very, very close cooperation first with the State Department of Transportation. We do that with transit providers, and we do that with counties and cities, as well as with the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And that cooperation crystallizes in a policy forum, which is called the Transportation Advisory Board, where cities and counties and state agencies are represented, and where a lot of our activities go through before they get to the Metropolitan Council. With respect to the transit functions, I'll talk very briefly about what are the type of things we do. The first thing we do is that we prepare long-range plans for the region for all airport, roads, and transit systems. The second thing we do is that we assemble a short-term transportation improvement program that is usually a 3 to 4 year program that includes all federally funded projects. And there you see the 33Ws, the Trans Highway 100, the Trans Highway 610, and so on and so forth, in addition to a lot of county and municipal projects. And so if you look at a transportation improvement program over 3 to 4 years, you will find $40 to $60 million for almost every single county in the metropolitan area, in addition to hundreds of millions of dollars over that 3 to 4 year period for the trunk highway system and improvements to the trunk highway system. In addition to that, we allocate about $50 million in federal funds through a competitive process, and we do that on a 2 year cycle. So every time we do that, we are allocating about $100 million. And everybody practically is eligible, cities, counties, states, transit providers, and we go through that process every 2 years through that transportation advisory board that I was mentioning before. We also approve major capital investments in the max capital budget. We don't approve every single little project, but we approve those projects that have metropolitan significance, and those are defined in statute what those projects are. And finally, we participate in a large number of transportation studies that are either initiated by us, by MINDOT, by cities and counties, and we are always part of that activity, and we provide a lot of technical assistance to those studies. With respect to the transit functions, I think Mr. William already pointed out to you what are the key functions that we perform. Metro Transit and Mr. Lamb, the general manager, will talk more about it, primarily provides regular route bus service to the region, and also right now has started providing the light rail transit service on the Hiawatha Avenue LRT line that you are, I'm sure, familiar with. With respect to my side of the business, the Metropolitan Transportation Services, what we provide are transit services that are not the type of regular route by service for the most part, but mostly either transit-dependent related services like Metro Mobility, which is the program for transit-disabled people, for disabled people. We do some contracting out of regular routes. We do some community programs with cities and counties, and finally we run a ramp pool program primarily for areas that are not receiving regular route services. In addition to that, we work very closely with opt-out communities, which are the ones that Mr. Williams referred to, and we pass through the money that is allocated through the formula of the invest transfer that was dedicated to transit 4 years ago. And finally, you have in front of you a budget which shows the revenues and expenditures of the regional transit project, and as Mr. William indicated, the larger portions of that budget come from either invest transfer or general fund appropriation. There is some federal funds. Of course, the fares play an important role. And I want to mention there that the fares there are showing the average regional fare for all transit systems, suburban, transit, metro mobility, metro transit. If you look just at metro transit, and maybe Mr. Lamb will talk about that, the percentage of the budget that is recovered from fare is higher than that, and close to a third. With respect to where the money goes, a large portion of the money goes to metro transit, the opt-out systems, and metro mobility. And then, as you can see, the rest of the programs are relatively small by comparison. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like then to ask Mr. Lamb to join us at the table, and he will do the rest of the presentation, and then we'll stand for questions after the presentation is completed.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the team.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Lamb. I'm the general manager for Metro Transit, and have slightly more than 3 months of seniority under my belt. I'd like to focus in a little bit on Metro Transit operations and give the committee a sense of what we do. And I'll get this straight again. Metro Transit is projecting to carry approximately 71.5 million rides on our various services in 2005. That breaks down to about 66 million on the bus side and about 5 million on the rail side. We carry about 93% of the region's ridership on Metro Transit services, either directly delivered or through contracts, mostly through the opt-out contracts in the suburban areas. We have
If I might, just for clarification purposes, is this Metro Transit only, or does this include your opt-outs, or no Metro Mall, or any?
This is
strictly the big buses.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, this represents Metro Transit only ridership numbers, and the focus I will have is on Metro Transit only over the course of the next comments. in Metro Transit, we have 850 buses and 24 rail cars. We received our final rail car in Minneapolis just this week. We operate service on 135 routes throughout the metropolitan area. There's almost 2,700 employees in Metro Transit, and we are, in terms of service miles operated, the 11th largest transit system in America. Who are customers? Metro Transit, actually, we survey on an annual basis, last one conducted in 2003. Approximately 82% of the trips, our customer trips, are for work and school. That breaks down to about 75% are work trips and 7% being school trips, with the remaining quarter coming from shopping and those other kinds of trips. Surveys have been done most recently by the Downtown Council, estimating that 40% of downtown Minneapolis workers use transit to and from work on a regular daily basis. And when we ask our customers who they are, 61% of them say they have cars, but they choose to ride transit. 36% have a household incomes above $50,000, and in fact, 19% have household incomes above $70,000. We actually ask them on an annual basis how, in a range of 1 to 5, how satisfied they are with Metro Transit services. And in 2003, fully 84% indicated that they were satisfied with the transit services that they were provided with. Metro Transit, in order for us to really succeed, we need to develop and maintain a good partnership with employers. As that is indicated earlier, that 75% of the people actually use transit to go to work. We've established several programs oriented trying to strengthen that partnership. As of right now, we have 103 employers are enrolled in our MetroPass program. That's oriented towards trying to provide tax incentives and lower cost fares for employees as well as for the businesses themselves. And in 2004, approximately 3.8 million rides were made on Metro Transit using MetroPass holders. The other programs that we have is that approximately 388 employers sell Metro Transit products through their Transit Works. That would be anywhere from a monthly pass to various other kinds of fare tools. And we found that to be very successful. Employers may ultimately subsidize part of that to provide other incentives for their employees. And we are also in about the fourth or fifth year of a partnership with the University of Minnesota. Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lamb, going back to your survey that you did, the way you've got 82% of the trips for work and school, how many people were surveyed in this study that you took?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I do not have the latest numbers for the 2003 survey. I do know that we do survey at a statistically reliable level within 3 to 4% error rate, I believe that's, but I can find out that number and provide that for you.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
As I was saying, Mr. Chair, that one of the programs we have going for the last several years in conjunction with the University of Minnesota is the UPass program, which is modeled after the MetroPass but is oriented towards university students, staff, and faculty. And last year, ridership on the UPass program was in excess of 2.7 million. If I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to spend just a minute talking about the 2004 activities at Metro Transit. As you know, this last year we did open up in two phases, both in June on the north end and also in December on the south end, the Hiawatha light rail line. We have just carried our 3 millionth customer, which is our ridership thus far has been about 100% over our initial projections, and we're very pleased with the initial ridership levels and customer acceptance of the light rail line thus far. Secondly, on the bus side, and I'll show you a map in a minute, we have just finished a significant restructuring of the bus service on the Central South Metro area, which impacts about 50% of our ridership, our best ridership area. We are in the process of a several-year program of fundamentally restructuring all of the bus transit system in the metro area and going around the region in a sector-by-sector approach. And I'll show you our area of emphasis next in 1 minute. Another area that we... Metro Transit took the lead in introducing ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel into the state of Minnesota. Ultimately, there's been an interest in the on the fuel side of from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency as well as the state of Minnesota to introduce ultra-low sulfur diesel, which has lower particulate emissions, into this state, and Metro Transit was actually the leading contractor to get that ultra-low sulfur diesel introduced. We approximately 40% of our buses right now operate on that low sulfur diesel. Another accomplishment in 2004 is that we reduced our overall number of accidents. We operate nearly 30 million miles per year in the metropolitan area, and we had a 10% reduction over our goal in the number of accidents in 2004. We provide special services for a variety of reasons. One of our more successful ventures is annually we provide additional service to the state fair, and last year approximately 27% of the state fair attendees rode Metro Transit services.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lamb, can you tell us what the cost versus fare recovery is on the state fair operation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Larson, our goal is to recover 100% of our costs, and last year we did accomplish that, as we have, I believe, every year since we've had this special state fair arrangement.
Thank you, Mr. Lamb. Mr. Chair, I'm sure many of us have used that. Our family's used it the past 2 years, and it was run very efficiently, and I was impressed by it, and I'm even more impressed to see the 100%.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out in this map that you're looking at right now is the Hiawatha line. Everything from the Fort Snelling Park and Ride north was opened effective June 26th, and from Fort Snelling, which includes the airport, all the way to the Mall of America, has been open effectively since December 4th of this past year. And in both phases, we have actually exceeded our ridership goals. The last map I just wanted to show to the committee is earlier I had made mention of our restructuring of transit services. We have, as I said, segregated the metro area into eight unique sectors. The first sector, two sectors, we implemented revised service in 2000 and 2001. With Sector 5 in your lower part of your map, just implemented this last December, and in this coming year, we will be looking at Sector 8, which is the northwest quadrant.
Representative Olson has a question here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lemmy, on the Hiawatha line, the exceeding your goals of ridership, Can you tell me what the effect is on transit overall in the area? Buses and light rail combined?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, as I indicated earlier, our projections for the year 2005 is slightly over 70 million rides that Metro Transit plans to deliver. Our bus ridership over the last 4 years has actually been down for a combination of reasons. First of all, we have, over the course of the last two bienniums, reduced our service on the street, this most recent biennium by approximately 5%, in the prior biennium about 3%. And also during the last 4 years, we've had fare increases, which also reduce our overall ridership. Comparatively, on the bus side, I believe that at our high point in more recent era, we had approximately about 73 million rides per year, and we are projecting this coming year to have about 66.5 million rides.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lim, what I'm really after is the net effect. I've seen one report showing that there's increase on light rail, but with the bus routes being rerouted to support the rail, there's an actual net loss in one report that I saw. I'd just like to...
So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, we... Prior to the rail opening in June, as you know, that we had a 44-day strike. Immediately after that strike, for the next month, our transit ridership overall on the bus side was down near 28% over where it had been the previous year. And subsequent to that time, our bus ridership has been steadily improving compared to a year-to-year comparison, 03 to 04. Our most recent month of release data, which is November 2004, our bus ridership is actually down about 3 to 3.25% over where it was in 2003, comparable month. Our goal is that by March of 2005, that our bus ridership would be back to where it was pre-strike, which means that we ultimately will have recovered from the strike. But our goal is not to shift ridership, if you will, just from the bus to the rail, but to have a growth plan for both bus and rail.
Mr. Chair, final comment?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lem, if I give you this report, could you comment on it for me so make sure I have a thorough understanding of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I'd be happy to.
Thank you, sir.
Let's see another report. What report are you talking about, Representative Olson? You got another report?
Mr. Chair, I don't have it with me.
Oh, you do have another report.
I'll
okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Yes, Mr. Lynn.
Mr. Chair, in response to an earlier question by Representative Anderson, I have been informed that this last survey that was done of our customers, we had 3,313 respondees to that survey.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lamb, thank you. Welcome. Really applaud the initiative on the hybrid buses, and I noticed in the Met Council budget that there were, I think, 14 buses slated for 07. What's the process? Are they is there funding for them? Is this just in the plans? How many hybrid buses and when over time?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I believe the additional number of buses that we are planning and have in our capital improvement plan is 20 additional hybrid buses. They are slated for 2007. There are two reasons, actually, why we put it out to 2007. First of all, this is a new technology, and as with any new technology, on the front end, you pay kind of a premium, and as the industry starts to address its federal requirements in terms of reductions of emissions and standards in terms of miles per gallon standards, is that we wanted to not be on the, I'll say, the bleeding leading edge, but also to be at a point where we believe the cost per vehicle will be down, so they'll be more, roughly more comparable to our standard vehicle.
Deputy Seaman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Lamb, for being here. I had a question about the sector studies, the last slide that's up here. Could you just explain it more? Because the numbers don't correspond with when each section looks like it's either been implemented or is under study. So first, just comment on how you just decided what to study first, and then more in depth, if you could please, about what you're actually studying.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Seaman, the transit system essentially was developed initially over 100 years ago. And what's happened over time is that it's grown incrementally. And you may have a new area that you want to serve here and over as the region continues to grow. And over time, it's like it gets to be like an untended bush that you need to periodically go in there comprehensively and understand where the travel patterns are for the 21st century, and then reorient and realign your resources so that you can better meet the travel needs for the residents and the businesses in that geographic area. We knew that it was virtually impossible to take the region as a whole and do that justice all at one time, because you really want to get down to a level where you're soliciting public and business input, you're looking at your resources, your budget requirements, and then you can try out different kinds of systems. So our plan is a multi-year plan that we essentially started in 2000, and actually 1999 for much of our study, for the first two sectors one and two on the upper right-hand side of your map. Those sectors were selected for two reasons. First of all, we knew that based on the population for that area, that our ridership was underperforming in kind of a prorated fashion, and that we wanted to really focus on an area that had not as much express service, and so to look at express opportunities, but also not as much neighborhood-to-neighborhood mm-hmm. circulation as we really felt this region, or that part, those two sectors could sustain over a long run. Sector 5, if you look at Sector 5 in the lower section of your map, that really corresponds with the Hiawatha Corridor, the South Central Metropolitan Area, Minneapolis, Edina, Richfield, Bloomington. Our ridership analysis over time has substantiated that that's where our best transit ridership sector is and has been for a significant amount of time. So as we thought through the implementation of the rail line, we thought through what we call the need for what we call a grid network, meaning crosstown services. Most transit service in this region, unlike other regions, is all oriented north and south towards the downtowns, and we have a unique two downtown metropolitan area, and we don't have as much neighborhood-to-neighborhood circulation. So we felt like this Sector 5 was really a ripe area to introduce and expand our crosstown service, and it's also an area with the burgeoning employment on 494, which is the southern part of the sector, to really put enhanced transit presence throughout 494 service area. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of the rationale. It's taken a good 3 years of good community input and planning to get the Sector 5 plan up and operational.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
And we have Representative Beard of 2 minutes on aviation here. I want you to raise your hand and tell me and swear that you've never had a meeting with a senator on this. We had some discussion about that earlier. Oh. Joint meeting, right? Is that me? You have been footloose and fancy free with the aviation sector here for a number of months, and what's been going on, I guess, is...
Mr. Chairman, I have no budget and a very loose description of the committee, so I've been all over the place. If folks are interested in aviation, I'm interested in talking to them about it. So, for the tape, I'm Representative Mike Beard. I chair the House Aviation Subcommittee, at least I did in the last session, and the Speaker has indicated that we will reconstitute this committee for this session also. I'll be looking for interested volunteers to serve on this. Bernie, Dan, a few others. Let me tell you how we got to this point, because for, 8 or 9 years at least, going back in some institutional memory that I've heard from, there hasn't been a specific committee that's focused on aviation affairs. I think when we had the dual-track airport process here a handful of years ago in the early 90s, there was some focused attention on it, but I'm speaking just of the aviation infrastructure in the state from Worrow to Worthington that involves business and general aviation, the second-tier regional airports, as well as Minneapolis-St. Paul. Unfortunately, when you say aviation, that's what all of you immediately think. You think Northwest Airlines and you think Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and there are actually 134 other very important airports in this state that are part of the aviation infrastructure. I came in the freshman class 2 years ago, of 43 of us, many of you around this table, and we sat in a room much like this because one of the first things we had to address, besides the $4.2 billion budget deficit, was in the current year that we were sworn in, we had a $384 million shortfall we had to fix right out of the chute before we could do anything else. The governor started shaking all the coffee cans, petty cash drawers, and everything in all the agencies, so to speak, to find any cash that was laying around at all. And one little pot of money he found was the Aviation Improvement Fund down at the Department of Aeronautics and the DOT. The one thing about that money is that it's statutorily dedicated. It's collected from aviation users in the form of fuel taxes, registration fees, and I think there's a passenger seat tax or an airline flight property tax that's collected. That's where those monies come from. They're kept in segregated accounts in the general fund, but they are then, in a budget crisis, subject to being confiscated or taken to be spent on general fund things, and that's just the way the game is played here. So I remember sitting in that corner of the room with Representative Leader beside me, and we both looked at each other and said, how in the world did Aeronautics amass, actually it was $17.9 million that they had not spent and had it sitting in a little savings account somewhere, for what purpose? No one seemed to know. No one from MnDOT could tell us, and nobody around the committee had any knowledge of how it worked. And so we went to the chair of the Finance Committee at that time, was Representative Bill Quisley. Quisley said, Beard, I want you to be on that. I want you to find out what's going on. Let's do an aviation subcommittee and look into this stuff and just kind of pay attention to aeronautics. So that, folks, is how the committee got started. So I was given the minimal authority not to actually do any bills or anything, but to actually start having aeronautics have a contact place here within the legislature, which is something they had not had in many years. I think the aviation community in this state, the industry itself, and there are several pretty, probably the most fantastic manufacturers, marketers, and engineering firms that you have never heard of because they deal on a national, international scale, but have little to do with us. Maybe a lesson for us there, but we won't go down that pike. But anyhow, they were very glad to know that the legislature was beginning to pay attention to just how important the aviation infrastructure is in this state. We're not just talking about airports and runways. We're talking about hangars. We're talking about commercial industrial land on those airports and how we keep that land somewhat segregated for purposes that benefit from having an aviation infrastructure, which the taxpayers of this state have paid for. And, oh, by the way, the users of the aviation infrastructure have largely paid for. Did I mention that already? So the long and short of, I think the first legislation that we passed bipartisanly was that of the $17.9 million that was in that fund, the governor took $15 million of it to help fill that $384 million emergencies that we had. But we did agree that when times were good again, sometime after July 1st, 2007, I think is the date we put in there to hold the place, we would put that money back. So I'm glad I'm here today, if for no other reason, just to tell all you new folks, there is a law in the books that we will put the $15 million back. We won't pay interest on it. There's no payment schedule or anything like that. But it is our intent, was our intent in the last session of the legislature, to use the money for a critical need at the moment. But when things got good, we would put it back and pay for things like navigational aids, landing assistance, terminal buildings, and so on and so forth for the aviation industry in this state. As we kind of looked into things, and I'll stand for questions here in a moment, there are just a couple other things that you should know that we kind of uncovered as we were looking at the general health and direction of airports, aviation, and air transportation around Minnesota. One of the things that many of the airports outstate are running into is growth, and growth's a good thing. If it's in Rochester or St. Cloud or Wilmer, the towns are growing out around the airports that have been there for 50 or 60 years. And once that happens, then you start to get into conflicts with neighbors and airplanes. But also you get into things you can't even see. Wilmer is a good example where some industry built. The buildings were not tall enough to encroach upon what we call a gradient rule, meaning they weren't actually a hazard to flight. But they sure did mess up some expensive avionics that were put into the ground for many millions of dollars, which rendered them useless. The further away from the airport you went, the bigger the dead zone. And so the state paid for moving some of the nav aids, and then darn if another company didn't expand and build a building, and we had to do this all over again. So we just opted, or the city officials in Wilmer and Candiota County just opted to move the airport about 5 miles west. That cost us about, Representative Junkie's not on the committee anymore, I think it was north of $9 million to do that. So that gave rise to some discussions about giving some more teeth and enforcement to the airport zoning and land use laws so that airport authorities can have a little more say not only over where a building's sited and what it's made out of, but how it affects things like navigational systems and flight patterns and so on and so forth. We don't have a lot of teeth in those things now. We make recommendations, and frankly, a lot of airport authorities aren't even on the loop when a county or a township changes a zoning plan or a comprehensive plan. We want to make sure that they are. The other thing is, every 5 years, the Department of Aeronautics at MnDOT updates their state aviation system plan. 1999 it was done. It was initiated again last fall. Chair Earhart asked if I would be the legislative member on that panel. And so I sit there sort of with one toe in this committee, but not really anymore. So with your indulgence, I would be happy to serve there again as this system plan unfolds over the next 12 months. But those are the two things we're currently involved in, land use planning and the state aviation system plan. And we'll be looking at a few other things going forward. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Yeah, Representative Byrd, was that $15 million primarily for outstate to include Geneva airports, or was it just outstate, or what? That's where the money was.
Yes, thank you for the question, so we can help clarify. In this, in the Twin City metropolitan area, there's an organization called the Metropolitan Airport Commission, which has primary responsibility for seven airports. It runs seven airports as a system, including Minneapolis-St. Paul and six what we call reliever airports. They operate a little bit differently than the other 134 airports that MnDOT Aeronautics has the responsibility for. Technically, Aeronautics is over all of them, but the legislature beginning in 1943 did clearly differentiate that the metro regional airports, the seven of them that are in the system, would be a little bit different and would be funded differently. And this is where there's been kind of a, if you can bear the term, gentleman's agreement between Aeronautics and the MAC team. This isn't really official, but this is what I've been able to determine so far, and this is just this representative talking. They all can respond to the FAA and ask the FAA for money. However, the MAC has a tremendous cash generator in MSP. MAC has taxing authority, bonding authority, ordinance authority, police authority, and zoning authority. They operate like a city without streets and bridges, what they operate like. So they actually run the concessions at Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport and levy rates and charges on the six reliever airports and generate a few hundred million dollars a year in revenue. The MAC has not levied a metropolitan-wide tax since, I believe, 1968-ish. All their bonds that they sell to do improvements are paid for by cash generated within the airport system itself. It is the best-run airport system in North America, bar none. Aeronautics, on the other hand, has 134 airports in the rest of the state that don't have a cash generator like the MAC has. And so the quid pro quo has been Aeronautics would appeal to the feds for, I think the ratio is 95 to 5 now, 95% federal money for 5% local match to do improvements in the rest of the state, and MAC wouldn't necessarily acquire that money and would use instead their own cash for improvements on the reliever airports, although there is some federal money that flows for special programs to Minneapolis-St. Paul International.
Are there any other questions? Representative Hersey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Beard, for your service. I was on the committee, and thank you. You did a great job. I hope you'll continue to function. I know that we've been focused a lot on the outstate airports, et cetera, but this expansion of MSP is perhaps one of the biggest aviation decisions since the original plant dual track system, where I think they were going to stick it down towards the Representative Cox initially, the new airport proposal. So we have this huge expansion, and it has implications for how competitive we'll be vis-a-vis other airlines, the 2,000 jobs potentially lost. Representative Larson and I are concerned about noise issues, and I guess I would address this to you, but if the chair of local government is here, they deal with the MAC, and we have the two transportation chairs. I'm concerned that a decision of this magnitude we've had really no hearings in the legislature. It's just been kind of done through the executive branch, and I think it's a huge statewide issue that has so many implications for the future of aviation. Do you see any role for the legislature? Are we going to have an opportunity to weigh in on this? I think the MAC is going to be deciding this in a couple of weeks, so any thoughts? Or maybe the other chairs on this?
Representative Brewer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, thank you for a minefield of questions there. The answer is yes, yes, I hope so, and I sure hope so.
Mr. Chair. Representative Larson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hornstein, I'll have a bill that you can sign on as a co-author coming very shortly.
Well, I guess that kind of winds it up then. Thank you so much, Representative Brewer, and we meet again on January 19th. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.